to the Handcrafted Podcast, where I talk to people in the arts and crafts and find out what makes them tick. Today I'm speaking with writer and storyteller Paul Draper. Now, Paul Draper partly is inspired by the landscape and the legends that he finds around him. He picks them up and weaves them into dark stories, but I don't think I should say too much more. What I'll do is I'm going to play you this clip of Paul reading an excerpt from one of his stories, and then we'll get on with the interview.
And there, forward crept the mistress. She was beautiful and larger than any spider that I'd previously seen on the heath. Her brown body was solid and fat, and culminated in the tapering hourglass shape of a typical British garden spider. Her legs, however, were more like that of a house spider, thick and hairy. I held up a pen and measured her at about 4 inches, front leg to back. Her approach dwarfed the large fly. "What's happening?" Jackie called. I shushed her. "I'll tell you in a minute," I whispered, wanting to witness this ritual in its entirety. Forward edged the spider. I'd expected her to grab the fly with the ends of her legs, circle to the thorax, and deliver a venomous bite, much as this class usually does. However, she surprised me. She reached out a single leg and patted the fly on one of its compound eyes. This prompted the insect to thrash about with greater urgency as it sensed the mortal danger. The spider then reached forward to trace the underside of the thorax, and then, with her scything mandibles flexing, snick, bit off a leg. I'd never seen such behaviour. I watched with a thrilled scientific fascination as this beautiful creature did her work. She moved around her hapless victim and severed each limb in turn, then moved to the wings and with an almost imperceptible snick removed those too. Before long, the fly was just an inert tube of dwindling life, mouthpiece twitching spasmodically, but no other means of movement possible. The spider then cast a light, lacy web about the ghastly banquet. Nothing stronger was needed before she crept back to her concealed resting place.
So, hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm very well, Richard. How are you today?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Thanks for agreeing to do this podcast for me. Really appreciate your time.
You're welcome. It's exciting to be part of something new.
Yeah. Well, and hopefully it will go on for many years to come.
Fingers crossed.
Yes. So, Paul, you're a storyteller and an author and a screenwriter. I guess it might be correct to call you a portfolio writer. Would that be right?
Yeah, I think so. I kind of use the term universal writer at the moment. So I sort of dip my hand into quite a few different things. But screenplays and prose and copywriting as well. So yes, lots of different forms.
Great, yes. And I've got your new book here, which I'm currently halfway through and I'm really, really enjoying it. It's called Blackgate Tales. When I say that, I feel like I should have a tagline to describe the book. What would you say that might be?
Well, I've listed it up on the sales platforms as 14 short stories of death, hope, and wonder. So it's a bit of a mix, really. Throughout all the stories, there should be a sense of kind of otherness, a sort of wider cosmic effect that's happening to the people within the stories, who often come to a bit of a sticky end, usually through fault of their own bad decisions.
Yeah, I've noticed that myself. What you've done really well for me is when I read it, you drop me into a story, someone's story, halfway through, and then you leave me still in their story, wondering where it's going to go. I think that's really a really nice effect of the way you've written these stories.
Thanks. Those are the stories that I quite like to read. I like to think that there's something outside of the frame, but what I don't want to do is leave people thinking that they should be hearing about the thing that's outside the frame rather than the thing that I've told them about. So it's nice to get a sense of a sort of that you are just sort of checking in and just seeing probably a fairly bad, somber incident in someone's otherwise long experience of other things.
Yes, it's interesting
Your description, your tagline that you just gave me, it's evident that you're into the darker side of storytelling. It really comes across. I think it's also important to be authentic in storytelling. I'm wondering, obviously, you can't plonk yourself into a horror story every night. I wonder how important it is to be authentic and how important it is to know when to break away from that comfort zone.
Yeah, it is important. I think good writing comes from being outside your comfort zone. I remember I was chatting to a very good writer who did Ghost Watch back in the 80s with Michael Parkinson. His name's Stephen Volk. And his assertion is that instead of being the most robust, bulletproof people in the world, horror writers and people who write dark fantasy are generally pretty frightened people. They're usually the sort of the most timid people around, and what they've done is they've had a look at the things that scare them and they want to kind of air them. So for instance, I'm not particularly worried about being buried under a mountain of grain, as what happens with one of the characters in this book, but there's a certain sense of sort of if you make the wrong decision, then bad things can happen. And I think that's probably a latent anxiety with a lot of people. So you're right about the authenticity, but also just being honest about things that genuinely get under your skin a little bit, and then having the process to be able to transfer that onto a story.
That's an interesting phrase, get under your skin a little bit. I'm thinking back at some of the stories and wondering why some of those things got under your skin.
Yeah. Well, they all come from sort of fairly, I mean, some of them are actually a competition story. So I was given a particular prompt to use. So a story like The Old Witch Elevator has a sort of an elevator that drops down through the Piccadilly Line underground stations, which is a genuinely creepy closed underground station in London. And it goes, you know, it goes into a sort of a strange other world. The elevator was there as a prompt within that particular competition story. And I thought about what I could do with it. And then I find competitions really interesting to write for, because they give you things that you might not otherwise select. We all have our own favorite sort of furrows to plow. So I think the closest to a natural furrow to plow for me is the King of Gorse, which you won't have got to because it's near the end of the book, but it's very folk horror-y. It's sort of a bit Wicker Man, and it's based on The White People by Arthur Machen, an old story that I thought was fantastic. So I do sort of love that folklore-y stuff, but it is nice to be told, look, take the sentiments that you have and the things that you like to put into a story, and here's a mandatory ingredient that you need to include as well. It's just quite nice. It's quite a nice exercise for a writer, and good things can come from it.
The King of Gorse actually is the next book that I have come to that I'll probably read tonight. The Old Witch Elevator one, it's funny you should mention that, which I read last night. Although I knew the name of the book, it was only towards the very last part of it, as the elevator was going down, that I remembered that was what the book was called. It's like, oh yeah, that's yeah. It's like I should have tweaked this earlier. It was really, I was so sucked into the story, the horror of it. Actually, that's one of the most horrific stories I think that I've read so far in the book.
Yeah, there are two sort of flat out horror stories, and I think The Old Witch Elevator is one, and Snick at the very end is another one. Snick is a very personal story based on the sort of childhood environment that I had near Ipswich growing up, sort of riding out on the heathland on a bike and just sort of trying to think up magic. And that wasn't written for competition. That was just a story that I decided to sit down and do one weekend. But Snick and Old Witch Elevator are the two sort of out and out nasties for the horror fans.
Great. I'll make sure I read that by candlelight in a darkened room. So you've had some success with your book of short stories, and I know you have some other projects on the go. I know that you're a screenwriter, for example. I'm wondering how important it is for you to have more than one thing happening at once.
I think it's important. I was reading an interview with Alice Lowe, who made Prevenge and was in Sightseers, a very talented actress and writer and producer and all these different strings to bows that people have in this sort of creative sphere. And she was saying that it's really important to just light as many little fires as you can and just start stuff. And you can start stuff all over the place. And a lot of things, I've got a sort of a TV project on the go at the moment, Faithless, which is based on the short film by Steve McCartan. And we're trying to convert that into a longer form project. And so some really interesting stuff's happening there, but the process is a long, long process. So I think if you do put your eggs all into one basket, you'll end up pretty frustrated or swinging your heels or running out of money, opportunity, or anything else. So you've got to get busy and not think, well, maybe I won't have time for that, because if it does come to fruition, because it might not come to fruition. So run around with a little match and just light as many little fires as you can, and they'll all get hot, I think, at different times and at different paces.
You mentioned that you read other people's ideas on how to progress, and I know that you go to a lot of conferences, etc., where other people of a like mind exist. I wonder how important you think it is to do that sort of thing, to keep connected with others around you.
I think it is important, particularly writing. It's not like I'm getting together with other musicians, for instance, and performing regularly. A writer will ultimately be sitting by themselves in a room on a laptop, ordering food from Deliveroo or something. So, you know, I think it is important to connect out. I mean, it's a lot easier now with Facebook and with other sort of social media platforms where you can connect and share your work and talk about stuff and ideas. So there is a genuinely more social environment now for people who are doing writing. It is important just to get amongst your own people. And it's been a real shame this year, because a lot of the organized stuff, like the London Screenwriters Festival, is they've just not been able to happen in person. There's nothing quite like just sitting down with someone new and just going, I'm doing this, what are you doing? And being genuinely interested in their work.
The social media side of things, I wonder what online platforms perhaps you find most useful, be it social or otherwise. I know you're heavily into self-publishing and you've done a lot of research on that. So I wonder what set of platforms work best, do you think?
From a social point of view, I've found Facebook's been brilliant, particularly with private groups. When it comes to sort of learning other technology that enables us to get our stuff out there, for me, there are old tried and trusted programs like Final Draft and Scrivener and various editing platforms. But when it comes to distribution with independent publishing, which is what I've been doing with Blackgate Tales, I've had to learn a whole host of new things. So a formatting software called Vellum I've needed to learn. Various online platform dashboards that you need to get to grips with in order to submit your books through. But I must say, you know, you take one step after the other and you get there sooner than you think. These things are pretty user friendly now, and we're no longer in the days where you've just really got to sort of move things across by a centimeter just in order to meet a regulation. You know, it's pretty user friendly, but you just need to have that awareness of what's out there.
Do you see a publishing house, a more conventional one, in your future, or do you think that it is solely self-publishing the way to go?
Well, the two authorities that I've been following on independent publishing are Joanna Penn at thecreativepen.com and Adam Croft from Indie Author Mindset. And they're both, you know, very, very successful. And I think both of them have had instances where they've had offers from traditional publishers and found that the process isn't quite agile enough for them. So they've actually taken some of their work back into independent publishing. The main thing is that you need to have the quality there. You need to be your own gatekeeper and bring in other professionals around you, like a very good editor, a very good cover designer, people who will actually, you know, deliver as good a quality as you might see through a traditional publisher. I think in the past 2 or 3 years, particularly, the wave has broken across independent publishing that it's now far more accepted. You're seeing independent publishing stalls set up at conferences and book fairs that you never would have seen before. So I think the traditional publishers and booksellers, I've just learned that I've got into Waterstones just through following this independent route. I think they're trying to figure out how to embrace independent publishing and still keep everything in good harmony so that everyone can be successful. So it's quite nice that it can exist alongside it now.
Yeah, I guess because if you're independent publishing, and correct me if I'm wrong, would you be using a print-on-demand route, which would mean that perhaps Waterstones wouldn't have you readily on their shelves? Would that be correct?
Yeah, I think print-on-demand has changed pretty much everything. Before, if you were doing independent publishing, back when it was more likely to be called self-publishing or even vanity publishing, like way back where you'd pay somebody for it, you would need to order a print run and then have them sitting in your back room and then figure out how to get those books out to people. But with print on demand and the new distribution services, and I must say that for all its drawbacks, Amazon has a world-class print on demand and distribution service, and Ingram Spark as well is another very good one. You know, it's entirely possible you can, that the wastage isn't there anymore. You can order and have something printed and delivered to you within a day or two. It's incredible how quick it is.
Yeah, that's great. And I suppose also ebooks are massive in this area for you as well.
Ebooks and audiobooks are two of the biggest growing markets. I mean, a lot of people, you know, we're probably in the same boat, love to have a book to hold and to, you know, take a book with us somewhere. But the portability of having a Kindle or another ebook reader or an audiobook device on your phone or laptop is just, it's exploded. And it's interesting to learn that I've learned that Amazon and Audible, for instance, aren't the biggest players in every country. There are other platforms that actually are bigger than those and are used more widely in other countries. So if you want to go out globally, you've got to kind of get your head around a little bit around these other platforms as well. But it's a massive growing market.
Yeah, that's really useful to know, because I'm sure a lot of people don't look much beyond their own shores or beyond Amazon. On the audiobooks, for this podcast, you kindly read us an excerpt of one of your stories. I'm wondering if that's the way you're going to go. Are you going to read all your own stories, or will you be using voiceover artists for that specifically?
I think so. I'm planning a novel this year. There are a couple of ways you can go around it. You can either obviously do it yourself, or you can have a narrator, a professional narrator. The thing with a story, when you're doing an audiobook version of a story, is it's not just a voice quality you need, it's the performance within the story. So for me, I'm going to get it out there first to see how it's received. And, you know, if there are any particular issues with it or feedback that it's not quite up to scratch, then I will probably get a narrator in. There are two ways of doing that. You can either offer a narrator up front 50% of the royalties that you'll receive for it, or you can pay outright for their service as you would with any other expert, and then keep the royalties for yourself. But that's obviously an upfront charge of a few hundred pounds. So it depends how people want to go on that route. But there's some great marketplaces like Findaway Voices and ACX for Amazon, who marry good narrators with authors looking for narrators.
Hopefully, most writers, I guess, would pay up front and own all of the future rights to their books rather than sell some of their IP.
I think owning IP and having as much control over IP as possible is the number one rule in all of this. The minute that you start giving things away by saying that you're going to go down an exclusive route or a route where things are shared out, you're suddenly entering the world of contracts and possible grey areas where people think one thing and then somebody else thinks another. So I think it makes good commercial sense, if you're going to be a sort of creative entrepreneur, to try and ensure that you've got the control as time goes through. And some of these contracts are long contracts, like with ACX for Amazon. If you give them exclusive lockdown on your audiobook sales, it's 7 years. That's a long time. So as much freedom as possible, I think, is the best way to go, even if you don't get the same amount of marketing and freebies that you would up front that you normally get when you go exclusive with someone. I think it's just sensible to keep control of your rights.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think probably the audiobook industry is learning from the music industry in that respect.
Well, yeah, absolutely. There's been many a storied case of famous musicians who, you know, end up in court over rights. So I think try and get it right to start with is probably the way to go.
Just one more question, if I may. You mentioned that you have a novel coming in the spring, I think. I'm wondering where you see yourself going from here? What's next?
I think my long game, because I am keen on screenwriting and films and TV, would be to show run an adaptation of my own novel into a series. So if I could helm something like a Breaking Bad or a Line of Duty that comes from my own source material, that would be me, you know, made up. So that's kind of where I'd like to go. I'm really interested in getting a novel series out here. The Parish Knives, which is the novel that I've got planned for next year, is the first of three books centering on the awakening of an old war under an English village. So I'm just going to keep on producing IP, as you know, if you want to be in cold commercial terms, but also just story stuff, and just see then what I can do with it. Because once it's there and once it's written, suddenly you have options. So you've got adaptations and various other forms of production.
The awakening of an old war under an English village sounds amazing.
It's going to be at different scales. So I've already got the three titles, they're going to be the Parish Knives, the County Guns, and the National Cannons. So I've got a kind of expanding concentric ring of scope. But what I want to do is I want to thread 10, 15 really interesting characters that are quite diverse and different, and some blackly comical and some genuinely scary, and just see if I can weave them all around into some big sort of messy tapestry of suspense. So that's where I'd like to go with that thing.
In my mind, it's going to be similar to the Age of Misrule trilogy that Mark Chadbourne wrote, where all sorts of historic events start occurring in current times.
Yes, well, I've not read that series, but I've heard it's really, really good. But I think that's a similar sort of premise. But for me, I'm going to try and center it on Gaia, the idea of Earth rejecting what we're doing on it as much as anything else. So there'll be a bit of a slightly green tinge to it as well.
Great. Well, thanks very much for your time, Paul. I don't want to let you go without asking you if you have anything you want to add, if there's anything that people should know about, perhaps promote your website, etc.
Well, I'm currently redoing my website, so maybe by the time this goes out, I'll have done it. But I'm at theblackgate.co.uk. This Blackgate branding is kind of something that I've been using for quite a while now. So news and stuff will appear on there. I'm on Facebook at It's The Black Gate, and that's where you'll spot new adventures. But I've got some exciting stuff lined up for this year. So let's hope it's a less difficult year for everyone than last year. And let's just march forward and see what we can do.
Marvellous. Thank you very much.